Roguecast is the official podcast of Rogues Gallery Comics and Games. Every week we talk about new comic releases, store news, and whatever movies, TV, and other pop culture is on our minds for the week. I'm Randy.
This is Dave.
I'm Nick.
And now on with the show. Welcome to Roguecast number 182. We are in our last September Roguecast. We are heading into October, which I believe is the favorite month of almost everyone here at Rogues Gallery.
Yep, except you, who despise it.
Except me, I love summer. Sorry.
You like it.
You'll come in and just Dave's head will be replaced with a giant flaming pumpkin.
That's actually just a condition I have. That's not actually does not have to do with Halloween.
Ah, okay.
It's like a specific Ghost Rider.
It flares up every once in a while.
Yeah.
I got it.
So we're heading in October. You have one more week to contribute to our charity of the month, which is the Rebuild Texas Fund.
Yep.
And then we'll be writing a check at the end of the month for that. And the last Saturday of September, which is this Saturday, we have a Magic the Gathering draft weekend. So we'll be trying out the draft for Ixalan. There's a promo card you get. You come in, you buy some packs, you do a draft, and you build decks and play. And then that night, starting at 8 p.m., is Ladies' Night. And you can come out if you're a lady. They're doing a book group for Wicked and Divine Volume 1.
Yep. And I'm sure they'll hang and talk and stuff too. But yeah, they're there for the book.
Yes, exactly. They'll do lady things. We don't know. We're not ladies.
Yep.
Nor are we gentlemen, really.
We're rogues.
We're rapscallions and rogues. Exactly. Yes.
I think some of them are rapscallions and rogues too. To be honest,
that's actually true. Yeah. It's ladies and female identified rapscallions night.
Yes.
But that's a longer thing, so we just shorten it. Then we have Saturday, October 7th from 1 to 4 p.m. We're doing our DC deck building tournament. That's been getting a lot of interest.
Yep.
Should be fun. We've got some fun prizes for that, like the Vixen card and a couple of limited cards that the fan gave us. So that'll be a lot of fun. And then we'll have plenty more stuff coming out of October, but I'll announce all that next week with our Gaming with Rogues and Halloween Comic Fest and all that kind of stuff. So let's jump to news.
Okay.
Because there's a lot of it this week. In fact, we already cut a few things out from our thread.
Prove it.
Prove that I cut stuff out.
Prove if there's so much stuff.
Okay.
What would it be?
Well, notably, Doomsday Clock, the new DC Watchmen thing that's being released, they've decided to do a thematic 3 minutes to midnight release for it.
I think this is actually pretty clever.
So they're going to release that issue at 11:57 on Tuesday, November 21st. Which means that we will be
correct
here
that
doing...
people have then about 3 minutes to read it before the end of time?
That's correct, The end of the world happens at midnight.
You are on a timer.
You weren't going to want to get in line early.
Yeah.
Going to have you may have those seconds may allow you to get to the end.
It's true.
But if you're at the back of the line, I'm sorry.
But yeah, so we will be doing that. We'll have more announcements on that as it comes, but kind of a cool thing. And
I actually think it's going to be fun. I will say, of course, from our perspective, what it means is DC went out and said, "Hey, guess what, Rogues Gallery management?
You're working late that night.
How would you like to work late?"
But if you've never read Watchmen before, it's a good time to pick up the graphic novel.
Absolutely.
And we're also taking pre-orders for Doomsday Clock. So if you want to add it to your sub, feel free.
We've already had lots of people adding it. Watchmen is only, like, the best-selling graphic novel of all time, and rightfully so.
I kind of feel like this, people are going to turn out for this. People are going to be curious.
I want people to come in costume.
Yeah.
I want Rorschach to come in and shake down the store.
I want everyone protesting outside for the first couple hours with the end is near signs.
Oh, man.
The end is nigh. Yeah, and somebody should... And then Dave will be Dr. Manhattan.
Yes.
No, I'm actually going to be the lady who the comedian smashes with a bottle, or she smashes him in the face, and then he shoots her.
Okay, you're going to do that?
Yeah, that's
very specific.
It's kind of a weird cosplay. I get it's a team thing.
Watchmen also got a pilot order from HBO. Damon Lindelof's Watchmen is moving forward at HBO.
I think he posted on his Twitter a photo of the bottom of the original Night Owl's trophy. From like
glory days.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So here's a question. I discussed this on my TV podcast last week because this news just hit. Do you guys think this is going to be sort of a faithful adaptation of Watchmen? Are they going to update it? Is it still going to be Cold War? You know, all
I think
kind of
I think the time period I bet will stay. The timeline will stay, but I'm betting they expand on it.
Yeah.
Long story short, I'm betting there's lots more character scenes. Dropping the dialogue of Alan Moore's that does not translate well to screen and getting scriptwriters to write more naturalistic dialogue that reads better to actors.
I fully expect them to take advantage of some of the stories in Before Watchmen, use that, and then come up with stuff their own.
So my question is, Watchmen as a movie makes a certain... If Watchmen is a series at HBO, not a miniseries, does that mean you don't lead to the big finale of it all? Because the point of Watchmen is a... It is sort of the deconstruction of that element. That story needs to be there. If you expand it, can you still have that power to it, or is it going to lose its ability?
I think so. I mean, the end of everything, the destruction of the world hanging over the thread, the heads, I actually feel like sometimes, you know, in the movie, for instance, I don't know if they really built up that Cold War fear.
Right.
And they had, you know, 2 hours, you can do it.
That was 3 hours.
Right. But I don't know that they really made me feel it. I think I saw stuff on, you know, that they showed the right scenes of, like, people, Nixon with a bad mask, talking about, how much will we lose of the U.S.? But I don't know if you're going to feel it, if I really felt it, and I feel like a well-done TV show, or for that matter, a better-done movie, can make you afraid of that apocalypse.
And I'm not
I actually feel like it could run considerably deeper.
I always worry about it because it's got to be a finite thing. Ultimately, it's got to it has that ending.
I agree.
Right. If they were to somehow go past that or whatever, it would be weird. Although I could see them going.
But,
you know how there is a suggestion at the end of Night. Night Owl.
Yeah.
And Silk Spectre kind of maybe even rallying sort of a new generation.
Yeah.
They could show a little bit more of that.
The question of what happens after Watchmen, it's too late to go back in the comics at this point, I feel like.
Right.
After if Moore had stayed with DC and done it, the question of the news of what happened coming out and what happens to the heroes and that kind of thing, like what happens to this utopian world that is built in the wake of the squid explosion, like...
Yeah.
That's an interesting story. I would love to see that story.
Well, actually, I do think it needs to end on a precipice. I think it has to be like the ending of The Thing. That is the structure. I just feel like if they wanted to, you could potentially have like a whole final episode that's essentially an epilogue in which you see Night Owl and Silk Spectre, and they've got their new team, and you know, you like Alan Moore, you try and find it's not just the raw plot of it, but you know, what does that mean for the characters?
Right.
What does it tell us about the world? And then you still, you know, you have as the backdrop for that episode that the magazine or whatever that's
digging
around for a story.
Here's my question though: can you think of a way for Watchmen to last 7 seasons?
No, and it won't.
Because HBO is looking for that hit.
Not in Watchmen.
I don't know. I feel like they want their next Game of Thrones. I feel like Watchmen could.
Wanted to, they could do a follow-up story.
Run
the risk of getting like if Alan Moore really, I don't think Alan Moore cannot stop Hollywood.
Nope.
But if
he could, he would.
they could get, you know, bad press. He and followers could really make a federal case out of it, essentially. He could really go public with how he felt DC screwed him out of the money.
I don't think he'll comment.
I don't actually think it's going to be... There's not enough of his followers to make that much of a difference.
I'm just wondering if there's... If you can see a story going along.
That's the question. Is there enough story in Watchmen to last 7 seasons? I don't believe there is, because I think that ultimately you can't spend 3 or 4 seasons on the height of the Minutemen and the Colt and the Vietnam War and all that kind of stuff. You can't do all that. People want to get to the main story.
When you said 7 seasons, I guess here's what I was thinking. I wouldn't necessarily think of it as 7 seasons of the expansion or something like that. So if the first season they adapted the graphic novel, and then in later seasons they approached other storylines, which is to say they chose other themes to explore through the characters, again, not just, the thing about it a little bit beyond just the raw plot stuff, but if they did a season that was before Watchmen, and then they did a season that was after Watchmen.
I can't see that. It feels like everything would be lesser. Like, everything's got to tie into the main story, the main narrative.
If the writing was strong enough, I feel like it could be done.
I see a zigzagging loss kind of back and forth.
At some point, Alan Moore had considered doing, I think, precisely that. Like, he was, as complete a construction as it is, I think Alan Moore could make it does seem weird, but could have done a complete construction of something else, a before Watchmen or whatever, and maybe even has notes on that somewhere, because... it seems clear in like the proposals and information and the things that he did okay the DC role-playing game and stuff, that he had other thoughts.
Well, he basically built up that universe in a lot of ways, the bare bones at least. So, I mean, there is enough stuff there.
I don't know. I have a hard time seeing it as more than like three seasons.
Dramatically speaking, doing anything after the finale is one of the riskiest things I can imagine.
Yeah.
I just think it could hypothetically be done. Like, if the writing was... Just assume the writing was as good as Game of Thrones or Breaking Bad or something like that, where you're like, oh, wow, you know, I'd like to see anything these guys do, because if they put two or three characters in a room, it's going to be sparks, and these guys know how to hit the emotional beats and all that.
And, I mean, the existence of Better Call Saul and how good that's been argues for a prequel being possible and being good, but... I don't know. Like you say, doing something after it seems risky. Doing something before it, to me, seems even more risky, because it gets to the point of these stories don't matter.
Well, you know, one thing that an area where I thought always Watchmen has something of a weakness in its kind of quasi-realism is the notion that the heroes, you know, it really seems like none of them have powers.
Yeah.
There's really, you know, of the ones we meet, what are there, let's say that there's 12 or 15 or something like that over the years. Like, it doesn't seem like that was even really almost enough to be a fad. You would have to have them in, like, all the major cities and stuff like that. I think you would have to... And if they showed us glimpses of that, like, that it was a bigger fad than we have been led to believe, that it was anything more than just, like, the smallest of, you know, groups piping up, you know, so something that where they might actually have some, at least some small effect on organized crime or whatever they chose to pursue, to go after... then they could introduce side characters that, you know, become the characters for a Before Watchmen project. Characters we've never even seen before.
I'm just going to throw this out here. An entire season dedicated to the villain Moloch.
I don't think that's actually the craziest thing. What if it was, like, about, you know, imagine the way something like... what's that show with Steve Buscemi in it?
Boardwalk Empire.
Mob show. Imagine a Boardwalk Empire type show told from his perspective, but with a branching storyline that showed... other people's perspective too, and you saw him trying to walk the line between villainy
and as a government assassin.
But you can't do these are all interesting stories, but you can't do them after you've seen the main Watchmen story, because then they don't feel important anymore. You have to weave them into the main narrative, I think.
I don't actually
think that's the case. But I would not probably do Moloch in those same characters. I think I would invent some other characters if I was
to. Here's what I think is likely. Damon Lindelof, neither of you guys watched Leftovers, right?
No, I tried watching it.
So Lindelof's Leftovers, which I thought was really, really good and got better as it went along, was three seasons, a complete story. And I think that is sort of what he's probably thinking of doing with Watchmen.
Yeah. Right.
Is a sort of a three season... 28 episode, you know.
Do we really think they're going to take the main story and expand it out to multiple seasons?
That would be my guess. What I would guess from the way Lindelof works, which is that he likes to do a main story and then flashbacks and side stories.
Yeah,
is that basically he'll incorporate all the flashbacks to the Vietnam era and the Minutemen era and all that kind of stuff. That'll get incorporated into flashback stories.
Yeah,
and the main story will be moving along at a slower pace.
I do wonder. Right, you could see like. You know, it could be a big thing when Russia invades Afghanistan and escalations hike, and it's felt in its presence of that is felt everywhere throughout the series.
And we'll finally see the giant squid.
I'm not sure we will. I still think the giant squid is something that they might do it. We'll see.
If they did that, I do wonder what the same way they broke up like The Hobbit and stuff or Lord of the Rings, what would be the finales to the earlier ones? You know, like if you did season one, would it be sort of about I would end it with the rise of Dr. Manhattan.
Probably. I also think the big reveal of the comedian and Sally Jupiter's relationship would be a big thing to do as a finale.
Yeah, that could be a strong finale.
There's a few big twists in there.
Right. That would if they did at the end of season two. Dr. Manhattan leaves the Earth. That would be the finale, I think.
Honestly, also, just the when Dan and Spectre take the owl ship out again after not being a superhero for so long, that's a big finale moment, too.
Yep. Yeah, and you can juxtapose those things. It would make perfect sense in Watchmen terms to have both a sort of a triumphant moment and a oh-shit moment.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm interested to see how you expand Watchmen.
Yeah. I feel like HBO and Lindelof have both earned my faith to a certain amount. Like, I'm not worried about this. Also, if it sucks, it doesn't really matter to me. We've already had a movie that didn't do it for me.
Yeah.
I've got the graphic novel. I don't really care. But I am optimistic about this.
You know, the one other interesting thing is that when the movie came out, 2000, what was that, 5, 8, somewhere in there, I basically thought that was sort of in its way Watchmen's last commercial hurrah.
Yeah.
That it would always be a perennial comic seller. Everybody would go through the rite of passage of reading it.
Yep.
But that was the last time the public would know about it.
Yeah, me too.
I guess it's getting another shot. Yeah. But that makes sense because, you know, they remade Ang Lee's Hulk after just a few years and all that stuff.
Yeah. All right. Other TV news is developing. Sean Penn is going to be starring in a new Hulu show called The First.
Uh-huh.
That is about the first mission to first manned mission to Mars.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be created by and written by Bo Willimon, who created House of Cards for Netflix. And basically, I guess it follows the first human mission to Mars, exploring the challenges of taking the first steps toward interplanetary colonization. Focuses not only on the astronauts but also on their families and loved ones, as well as the ground team on Earth. So it sounds like it's sort of a the Martian kind of thing, a little
right.
bit.
With a little bit of Apollo 13 too, with the families and stuff involved.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting, there's been several movies, aside from the 90s had, you know, Ghost of Mars and some crap-ass movies, and one awesome movie called Total Recall. Mission to Mars was the other one. And then we have had The Martian and stuff. What's weird to me is that we're getting all this sort of, like, somewhat serious speculation. I know there's that TV show that used sort of documentary-esque techniques and stuff.
That was on Nat Geo?
Yeah, what was that called?
I forgot.
Red Planet
what
or something?
Something.
Anyway... we're getting all this, like, serious speculation about what it would be like. And I don't know. It almost seemed feel like, I'm like, are we going to jinx the real mission? You know? It's weird because, like, before we went to the moon, there weren't, like, tons of... there were stories about going to the moon, but they were all very fantastical in nature.
Yeah.
We didn't do, like, serious stories about what we thought NASA would really be like walking around on the moon.
Did we not, or we just not know about them?
I mean, no, I don't think so. I mean, you know, there's...
We thought there were moon monsters. And
yeah, there was just, like, all the way through the 50s. You know, I do think, like, Ray Bradbury and some other people, yeah, they did write some more stories about that. I guess in the realm of prose, it at least was kicking around.
That's essentially what it was. The TV and movies were not the same thing at that point.
Right.
That's why.
They didn't have serious sci-fi as
an
idea yet.
But sci-fi definitely was there. Like the books
right.
had done that kind of thing. So.
Well, I'll say this of the new one. Sean Penn's a really great actor.
Yeah.
Kind
of a
and,
jerk.
But yeah, but I don't care about his personal life for the purposes of this show.
I thought it was interesting that, I mean, this is the first television work that he's ever done that I'm aware of.
I don't really know, but yeah.
For some reason I thought he'd done something else, but maybe not. Maybe not.
I mean, he may have come when he was originally starring to come up, but this is for Hulu. Hulu is on a hot streak at the moment with its awards for
Handmaid's
Tale.
Yeah.
And it's got Runaways coming up, so I definitely feel like they're taking some chances, and I think this is probably going to turn out pretty good. I'm curious to see the first trailer. But.
Yeah, I'm also curious.
He is the astronaut or whatever?
He's one of the astronauts, yeah.
Sean Penn is not like a sprightly young man.
But you know,
he's
astronauts aren't
50s?
Always that young. Yeah, he's in his 50s, I would guess.
Right, but and I'm just thinking, like, you know, my thought would have been a Mission to Mars person, though, that they would want somebody at kind of peak physical fitness.
He may be, like, the mission commander or something.
Yeah, I can see that. And it also may be one of those things where it's, like, you kind of want someone who's kind of lived a life so that they don't feel like... They feel like if they are going to somehow die or there's no return mission or whatever, that they're psychologically better prepared for it.
Or maybe he's playing a person that's already on Mars that we've colonized and he's doing a flashback sort of thing.
Maybe. Do we know that?
Weird.
That would be a little weird.
I don't believe that's what's going on.
Maybe he's playing Moloch. I don't know.
Maybe he's playing the Moon Man.
I'm just guessing.
Maybe he's playing the Watcher, who, as we all know, lives on the blue area of the moon.
You're talking about the moon again, but we're talking about Mars here, Randy.
Oh, you're right. Yeah. You're right. Maybe he's the Martian.
Jeez, Randy, that's
maybe he's
stupid.
The Martian Watcher.
Maybe he's Dr. Manhattan. He was on Mars.
He was on Mars. It's true. Good point.
I hope they find the crystalline clock structure thing.
Yeah, me too.
Anyway, but yeah, that sounds interesting. I'll be definitely interested to see the first trailers and get its vibe when it hits.
Yeah. This one does not have a network yet. It's just speculation, but it's interesting. Jordan Peele, who directed Get Out, among other things, he's working on a new TV show called The Hunt, which is about a group of vigilante Nazi hunters who track down Nazis in America in the 1970s and kill them. He's executive producing alongside David Well. Apparently it is based on some part on a true story.
That's what I was going to ask. Is this like Simon Wiesenthal kind of...
But it's like inside the United States. Like,
yeah.
Like they're hunting
I do
down
know that there's always like... I'm always hearing crazy stories that I'm like, wait, that really happened?
Yeah.
I don't know about this, so I do think it's probably ripe territory.
Anyway, I don't think there's a market for people hunting Nazis inside the U.S. right now. I don't know where if that ties into anything.
I think I would probably take the job application if I was in front of me.
So, yeah, I'm excited about this. Jordan Peele showed himself to be a pretty impressive director in Get Out. He's got good instincts, and
a sense of intertwining a social kind of commentary mm-hmm. with a story. I don't know how this one will end up relating to our times, but I guess there's a link.
Yeah, maybe. it's interesting, and I'll be interested to see where it goes. Some interesting stuff out of CW, a few things. Chilling Tales of Sabrina is in development as a companion to Riverdale, starting in maybe 2018.
For just a minute, I heard that as the Chilly Tales.
The Chilly Tales of Sabrina.
Chilly cooking with Sabrina. Chilling Tales. Is this based in any way on the comic itself?
They're using the same name.
Yeah.
But it's probably going to be its own darker Sabrina story,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
I want it to be sort of set in the 1960s like the other one.
They could actually have fun, and they would probably do a different vibe to it.
Yeah.
But it's going to be CW.
They're going to do a spooky, but they are going to do it like a supernatural Chilling Tales.
I kind of hope that at least like the comic, it leans dark.
Yeah.
And like the comic leans very dark.
Yeah.
And I have to remind myself, when I say CW... CW did some great horror stuff with Supernatural, and there was some legitimately scary,
creepy stuff.
So when I think
of that that clown on the side of the road waving,
yeah.
in that one episode, there was some pretty spectacular stuff in there. Who's starring?
Do we know anything yet? It's just in development.
Okay. Well, you know, it's one more thing that What's-His-Name can produce instead of writing the comic.
Yes, that's correct.
What's-His-Name?
Roberto Aguirre-Sagasa.
Right. Guy who both Afterlife with Archie and the comic Chilling Tales of Sabrina, both we see an issue like every 3 or 4 months.
But they've managed to turn Archie into kind of a powerhouse, haven't they?
Yeah.
Have they? Has Riverdale gone well?
I mean, Riverdale had great ratings. That's why
wanted to do this. I wasn't sure how it had actually done.
Season 2 is hitting soon. And then, if they expand to this.
Also, we had some casting news for Supergirl that they've cast Amy Jackson, who's mostly known for Bollywood work, as Saturn Girl.
Yeah, that was interesting.
Which makes the second Legionnaire after Mon-El to show up on Supergirl.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
It's time. Where's our Legion?
Yep.
Where's the Brainiac 5?
Well, it's clearly happening.
They keep moving toward it.
If they stay at least somewhat true to the comics, then what we really will need to know is who's Cosmic Boy and who's Lightning Lad.
Yeah.
Those are the original trio. Mon-El's always kind of somewhere off to the side.
Yeah.
He's a quasi-Legionnaire.
Yep. Legion will not be the crossover this year, though, because the crossover announced with this really nice piece of art by Phil Jimenez is Crisis on Earth-X.
That's what that is. I saw that floating around, but I didn't know what that was.
So basically, it's going to be a crossover between Arrow, The Flash, Legends of Tomorrow, and Supergirl, and they're going to be fighting... Earth-X is famously the Earth where the Nazis won World War II.
Uh-huh. Yep.
So again, for some reason, Nazis are in the air.
Huh. I'm going to bet punching Nazis is going to be in the
punching
air.
Punching Nazis is in the air.
Nazis are going to be hitting the ground.
I saw a Stephen Amell tweet, and he's like, getting ready to do the most craziest, most fun crossover ever.
Yeah.
Well, like, what I really want to see is, you know, a bunch of alt-world Nazis or whatever sitting there with their tanks and looking smug and superior, and then they open up a little dimensional gateway, and like 100 T-Rexes come out. with the Legends of the Tomorrow guys leading them.
I think the last four-parter was okay.
It was okay, but not great.
Yeah.
I'm hoping that this will be better. But they're going to bring in, like, the Ray, who they introduced in the animated series, just like the Vixen.
Yep.
They've got, you know, the new Black Canary. They've got Wild Dog.
Yep.
Like, it's crazy all the superheroes they're going to be in this thing.
Yeah, you have to look at the CW DC universe and, like, they have a lot of heroes and villains, so they have a lot of ammunition.
So that's tail end of November, and that's kind of exciting.
What I really want to see is a montage of every single hero in the DC CW universe punching a Nazi, or in some way arrowing them, blowing them up with a whirlwind.
I mean, Flash could just speed punch all of them.
That lucky bastard. All right, what else we got?
Trailers.
Yep.
So we saw the Punisher trailer.
Yep. Yep, aka Metallica. Having not ever watched Daredevil Season 2, I don't know how much they're tweaking the origin they've shown.
That's what they're not tweaking. That's sort
so
of what it was.
So what was his origin in that season? How did his family get killed?
It was like military, like, Blackwater type people.
Okay, and why were this. Do we know exactly why they were killed?
No.
Kind of a, he knew too much, yeah, he had stumbled onto something he didn't know about.
I think that is what it was.
Yeah, but so like he's going up against a conspiracy of, like, they mentioned, like, the FBI and the CIA, and
we were talking about, yeah. There is a creepy, fascistic thing side to the Punisher that as originally conceived when he was purely a clean-up-the-street crime,
yeah.
Which anybody who looks at the larger picture of anything knows that street crime funnels down from creepy white-collar crime and... Yeah. You know, attempts at to ghettoize,
it's
essentially.
More, it's more complicated than it was presented in the 70s.
And yeah, right. In the 70s, you just wanted to see, oh, I want to see a drug dealer get shot. I want to see a mugger get shot.
So, the Punisher, there's still a little weirdness about this sort of ultra-violent guy going after the government.
Right.
It's a little...
We have seen, like, it's the people who have, like, creepily embraced the Punisher in the real world do tend to be, like, Blackwater guys.
Yeah.
And if that's actually who he's going up against, that is a finger to them, I think. Yeah. And I do appreciate that. I think reconceptualizing him a little bit, I think, is kind of important in modern day.
I was, just because of elements of that, and also because I just have been down on the Netflix stuff, I was not looking forward to the Punisher stuff. But after seeing this trailer, I'm like, that's a solid trailer. Like, well, it looks pretty good.
Bersnell brings something to the table. Yeah. He's a really good actor.
He seems to capture disturbed but somewhat sympathetically.
Yeah.
So
they did that well.
We saw their microchip, which was, is he more like kind of a gawky skinny guy?
Yeah.
I'm
gonna start a hashtag fat microchip.
Yep. Was he like fat middle aged microchip?
He was fat middle aged glasses microchip. Yeah.
You know, yeah, in the movie Heat, you know the guy they get the schematics and stuff from, who's like a, looks like he might have been an ex-Vietnam vet who was in a wheelchair.
Yeah, that guy.
That guy seemed closer to a traditional microchip guy, and probably as he was originally conceived.
Yeah.
But
we're also going to get more of Debra Ann Woll's
Karen Page.
Karen Page. I know she's going to be heavily in this.
What's the link to Karen Page?
They formed a bond.
They formed a bond in season two.
I kind of like that as a story element.
Yeah, it's good.
I feel like Punisher as a persistent character, especially in a TV setting where you're going to need the dynamics of the actors playing off one another a little bit, that having somebody who's sympathetic to him or quasi-sympathetic is an important thing.
Punisher has always needed a supporting cast. It's kind of like what we liked about Flash when it came to CW. Yep. The Punisher has had Microchip, and he had a supporting cast. He's always had, like, maybe some cops.
A love interest.
Everybody brings somebody in. Ennis brought in these, you know, his goofy regulars. Nathan Emerson brought in some people. Greg Rucka brought in some people. None of them have really stuck.
Right.
Microchip
is the closest that there's
been. He needs a better supporting cast.
And a small spoiler, I know they're bringing Punisher's van, so he has that.
The
companion.
Battle van?
Yes.
That's the only companion Punisher needs. I know his notion was to sort of simplify him, and although the story was told largely through glimpses of the mafia types, and then also some, so like CIA and like cops and stuff pursuing Punisher, or with the same goal as him, but in a different angle. But his notion was that the Punisher was a super simple guy. You always knew what he would do in any given situation.
And
I think
the Terminator.
Right. He's basically a Terminator for justice. because he did create a fascinating world around him, I think he was able to pull that off. But yeah, the Punisher himself had no particular depth in his run, but the stories did. So. You know, for TV, I think it's best to have some kind of supporting cast.
Yeah, you need it.
Yeah, I agree. Two other trailers, both movie trailers. One is Molly's Game, which Nick caught, and I guess is a Aaron Sorkin production.
Yeah, actually, this is kind of cool. He both wrote this, and this is, weirdly, it's the first time he's ever directed anything.
Huh.
He didn't direct The American President. Oh, that was Rob Reiner, wasn't it?
He's written everything, and he wrote West Wing and all those, and he was definitely on set, and his word was kind of law, but
he was
never
like,
directed.
I did not know how to use camera.
Well, yeah, sure. And he was always a writer, so this is the first time we've actually are going to see him behind the camera, and it looks good. It's
pretty slick-looking production.
So this is a true story about an Olympic-level skier who ran a private poker game for, like, the wealthy and powerful, and then she gets caught and
has to sort of turn evidence, but won't do anything but herself.
It's a weird... it's a weird outlaw to get behind. I'm like, did she do that was so noble?
Yeah.
Right. Well, do we presume that she did do something noble and it's not just like he's fascinated with the story or something?
I don't know.
It's
based on her book.
Right.
Yeah. So I think he's probably more fascinated with her. Yeah.
Right. Or maybe there's a particular moral quandary she was in that he feels like kind of illustrates something he likes to talk about.
Well, Sorkin has never been great at acknowledging the powerful and their privilege. So
I mean, he did the, was it The Social Network, which was not about a great hero.
No.
In fact, he was a particularly flawed person.
I think he likes his flawed characters.
But I mean, it's not only that interests me and what Sorkin brings to the table, it's the cast of actors that they've got.
The premise holds no interest for me, but the cast is fantastic.
I mean, it's
Jessica Chastain is the lead. Idris Elba's her attorney.
Kevin Costner.
Yeah.
Even Michael Cera
is there to bring it down.
Michael Cera's there to bring it down. Yeah, exactly right.
You know, I think with Social Network, I think he was both fascinated with the rise of Facebook and, you know, the pros, and I'm guessing he would lean on the cons of it, but also the, you know, the personalities that went into the making of it.
Yeah.
You know, the fact that it began as, it wasn't it like sort of a rank the chicks on college campus sort of thing?
He also wrote the Steve Jobs movie, and that was definitely a look at a very flawed character.
Right. He does seem to like seeing how people who interact with sort of the wealthy and powerful.
Yeah.
Sometimes who, like, you know, Social Network guy who was like a nobody prior to it.
Yeah.
I'll be interested to hear what his angle on this is.
You know what else is a little weird is that Jesse Eisenberg was the guy at the head of Social Network.
Mm-hmm.
So why does he have Michael Cera in Molly's Game? Did Jesse Eisenberg drop on? He's like, and Michael Cera just showed up, and he's like, oh, yeah, we worked together on Social Network, and he just didn't know.
Yeah, he's like, okay.
Yeah, sure.
Is it possible that Cera killed Eisenberg
and
took his place?
I have never seen the two of them in the same place, is all I'm saying.
Eisenberg is persona non grata after ruining Luther. Sorkin can never forgive him for that, because he's always loved Lex Luthor.
It's also possible Eisenberg has been busy making Now You See Me 3, which I don't know if that's actually happening, but maybe.
It seems as plausible as anything else.
Yeah, it does.
All right, what else we got?
We've got the Tomb Raider trailer.
It's based on the last couple of video games where they youngened up Lara Croft, toughened up the game.
She has like a bow and arrow now.
Yep, they've definitely made it more of a survival enterprise.
Yep.
And did it very well. I mean, I've only played the first game of it, but I thought it was fantastic.
Cradle of Life, isn't that what it was called?
That was
a movie sequel.
Oh, right.
The Angelina Jolie.
I can't remember the subtitle of the Tomb Raider.
This was called Tomb Raider. Lara Croft is younger and hotter now.
So. I don't know that she became hotter because she was younger.
Yeah.
Some of the
actresses. Who's the actress? She's
Alicia Vikander.
Yeah,
who's great. She was in.
What was she best known for?
Ex Machina. She was the robot in that.
Right.
She was. There's something else she's notably been in. I mean, I'm blanking on it, but you've seen her in stuff, and she's great.
Okay.
And it's got a few other, like Nick Frost shows up in it, and there's a few other people who show up in it. I thought the whole thing looked very cliched. It's like, her dad leaves her a video, and he says, if you're seeing this, I'm dead. The fate of the world is at stake. Go to this place where nobody else has been. Save the world. Put this artifact back in its place.
Tomb Raider game stuff.
I mean, that sounds exactly like the Tomb Raider game.
But those aren't necessarily good movie stories.
I'm a little wary because the Tomb Raider movie, the original with Angelina Jolie, I really disliked.
Yeah.
And so I don't know how much interest I have in this one, but the trailer is solid.
Yeah. I think the trailer looks fun, and I like the property, so I'm hoping.
I love the game of it. I don't particularly see Lara Croft as a character that's good for. That's honestly good for the movies. I think she's a great video game character.
I agree.
She doesn't have a ton of depth to her. Supporting cast was fun. Like I liked them, and I would say actually beyond fun, they had some fairly well drawn characters. Clearly, at this point, influenced by the Uncharted series. By the time they kind of revamped it, and so there was some more nuanced characters in there. But
I want some video game movies to make good.
I want them to, but I've yet to see one that I think is going to pull
this
it off.
This doesn't look like the one.
No.
And in fact, I can't envision the one.
Yeah, I can't either.
I can't think of any property out that's like so good now that I think if they adapted it that it would be the one.
Mass Effect could have been.
Nah, Mass Effect is just going to end up another action movie
with
some
smart
elements.
Uncharted.
Uncharted's not going to be it. The problem is all these all these games are, at their heart, they're based around a story that is a video game.
And they're also, they also use tropes very heavily. They're not exactly about high innovation. So here's the thing. Like, I love the Mass Effect games, but they are still designed to ultimately put you in a ton of first-person shooter situations. They still, you know, are about, like, you know, people running around in battle suits and stuff like that.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not sure. I can't imagine a video game that, well, like, I love the Overwatch world that, like, Pixar was to do. They were to do something like a Pixar movie, Overwatch. Like, I could see that being a first good. But it's still not going to be the same thing as, like, when Marvel suddenly broke superhero movies onto its own thing.
Right. Yeah. No.
And I think part of it, it is because, like, the comics that inspired them, even as much as they've changed them, those were storytelling mediums that were about crafting finite stories and not long-term experiences, which is what video games are great at.
I would kill for an Overwatch animated series, though.
Yeah, me too, for sure.
Yeah, I think that would probably work pretty well in that form. But yeah, as far as a story that's going to move you, that's going to give the actors something to have some meat on it.
It's tough. Yeah. All right, that's it for news. We'll be back in just a second to talk about comics for the week. We're talking comics for the week of Wednesday, September 27th, and I'm going to kick it off this week, guys.
All right, do it.
I'll say, first of all, this is...
You stole my pick.
I stole your pick.
Yes,
I did.
Actually, there was a lot. There was quite a number of picks this week.
Yep.
But this would have been one of my possibilities. So in other words, I'm giving it the double vote.
Well, what I was going to say is this was a smaller week for me. Like, there wasn't as much to read as the last couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. But it was also, in general, a better... Like, everything I read, I really liked.
Yeah. That was the case for me. And I think I actually felt like I also had a few more options. But that's just the kind of, like, whatever connects with you.
Yep.
It's, I think, a pretty strong week.
So this is a book that I know we all liked. And I picked it because I like to steal Dave's picks.
Yep.
Because he does it to me all the time. This is Generations the Americas. It's the Sam Wilson and Steve Rogers Generations.
We've talked about how we keep picking the Generations.
There was one Generations I didn't love, and it was the Iron Man Ironheart one, and I know that Nick liked that one.
Yeah, I liked that one, and I only didn't like the Captain Marvel one.
Oh, that one. Yeah, I wasn't crazy about the Captain Marvel's one.
Right. That one just didn't...
But by and large, the track record has been somewhere between good and great for everything else, and they went out on a great note with this week.
Yeah, because this week there was this one and the one that Nick's going to talk about. But so the Americas is also... This is Nick Spencer's sort of Cap finale. It's his capper.
Yep.
For the Cap run.
And it is an interesting way to do it.
Yeah, because basically, for those who don't know, by this point, if you don't know, you haven't listened to our podcast.
Yep.
But Generations is a thing that happened toward the tail end of Secret Empire. In the final issue, they revealed that Kobik basically sent all these heroes as sort of a gift through time to go in and check in on their past, their legacy characters as a, like, at their peak.
To show them why they
themselves are
the
younger, newer versions, and they were sent back to meet the counterparts, or the ones who inspired them.
Yeah. So this is Sam Wilson winds up in World War II. Like, right at the beginning, as America is just about to enter World War II. And interestingly enough, most of these are like a thing that takes place in, like, over the course of a day.
Right. Yeah, this was a very different kind of story.
This was like that, what's the Sleeping in Light or whatever it was, the one that, the thing Star Trek did where Picard winds up aboard a probe and lives a whole life.
Yes, it is very much like that.
So basically Sam Wilson, he knows from talking to Tony Stark and some other people, like, and Reed Richards, he's like, when you time travel, you keep your head down, you're trying to change much. But,
so he takes on an identity and kind of starts something of a life.
Yeah, he basically he signs up, joins up in World War II, becomes essentially the Golden Age Falcon, although it's all, like, undercover because he can't reveal himself.
Right,
and even to the military that he's working for.
And winds up working with Cap at his youngest when Cap is still not, you know, Cap's still throwing up effort battles and not sure of himself.
Yep.
And he gets to see Steve Rogers at the age where sort of Sam was, where he wasn't sure if he really was worthy of the shield. And then what's amazing is it goes beyond that. After the war, he, like, goes on to be, like, a preacher and would be in the civil rights movement and is there when Cap wakes up and is basically gets to sort of watch himself become the Falcon.
Right. It's a role reversal of you know, Cap's role, but it's also an exploration of an idea of this kind of, like, a completely alternate life for him.
Yeah. It's really well done. It's very emotional, and it is a Sam Wilson story, but it also has a few things to say about Steve Rogers and what Steve Rogers is going to be getting up to. It serves as a a finale to what Spencer's been doing in his run, which to me is the best cap run I've seen since Brubaker.
Mm-hmm.
I will easily put it in that yeah. place. And it's got a really solid ending. It has me anxious to see both Falcon number 1 and Cap 695, which is what comes next. So yeah, I really recommend this.
It also had, by the way, great art. I don't know who it was.
Oh, yeah, Paul Renaud does the art, and he's great.
He did a great job. But yeah, it was an emotional issue. There was like at least two scenes, I think, where I felt like I teared up a little bit.
Yeah, yeah, I got that too. Yeah.
And I was like, this is probably as good a capper as you're going to be able to do for a run.
Well, yeah, I think I agree. This is probably the best portrayed that Sam has been in a long time.
Yeah. I feel like his whole run has been this character.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But this story that he told with him kind of brings it all home in a certain way.
I agree.
Yeah. Nick, why don't we go and jump to you, because you can talk about the Other Generations book, which, by the way, even though it's a Bendis book, I also liked.
But I was going... that is my secondary pick.
But talk about Generations.
Okay, well, I will weirdly do my secondary pick out of order.
Let's change things up.
We will mix things up. Mine is the Generations of the Spiders,
yeah,
which is Miles Morales and Peter Parker. And this is Miles being sent back to a pretty pivotal point in Peter Parker's career, a specific story.
Right. I think we don't want to say
we don't want to.
But it is clearly, like, this is in the Lee Ditko or Lee Romita Sr. era.
Right? Yeah.
And when he's in Peter's in college, I think.
Yeah, Peter's just started going to college, and Miles shows up randomly. He doesn't know where he is, doesn't know why he's dressed the way he is, and he runs into this young Peter Parker, who is sort of flummoxed and kind of bandying about. They run into Flash and a few other random Parker crew. And there's kind of a touchstone for Miles Morales because he can't resist seeing a portion of that time period that he's in. And it's just about these two characters and sort of where they are both emotionally. And I feel like Bendis...
What's interesting about it to me was that you see... It's a character thing. It's one of those ones where it's like they're not like, let's go stop Dr. Doom together.
No, this is all character stuff, which is what Bendis does best.
It's Miles looking at Peter's life from the outside in, in a way that, like, you know, we the reader have always done, and we're aware of, like, all the things that Peter suffered through and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But it's rare that anybody else has recognized it, and certainly that anybody has talked to him about it.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what occurs, don't you think?
Yeah, very much so.
There's a scene early on where some of Pete's, like, I don't know if I'd call them friends, but, like, it's, like, Flash Thompson and a couple other people.
And Harry and...
Yeah, but they're kind of, like, talking about screwing around with him and, like, pranking him and stuff like that. And Miles kind of blows up at him. He's like, you guys are being jerks. He's like, I thought you were his friends. And I think it's kind of, in some ways, I was like, I always kind of wanted to say that stuff reading it, you know, is that frustration you feel at when he was, like, Peter Parker who could never catch a break.
Yeah.
But then some very interesting things happened with Miles.
Yep. I thought that stuff was great.
And do we want to say, like, what...
No.
Okay.
But what Randy said is that when Bendis writes personal stories and sort of... I mean, I don't want to say talking pieces, but this is, you know, doesn't have any action.
Right.
And he does it very, very well. And, I mean, since he's the creator of Miles Morales, it sort of makes sense.
Yeah.
But I really like his take on Peter Parker, especially at this sort of emotional point that he's in.
Right, he's actually a little bit kind of angry and flustered for reasons you don't initially know other than we know his life is always in kind of a turmoil in
these
days.
Right, but at a certain point, Bendis is not always the best guy at continuity. He has made a number of flubs.
Yeah.
But he nailed it here. He finds a Marvel moment that is actually perfect.
Yeah, and I would be remiss if I didn't talk about the art by Ramon Perez.
The art is
great. It's beautiful. I think works completely in concert with Bendis' story.
It sort of evokes, you know, the look of the Romita Sr. era.
Yeah. Oh, very much.
He's got sort of the clean line illustrator style.
Yeah.
So the characters, you know, but characters have a lot of emotion, but there's also that sort of little bit of Ditko and Romita's energy to them.
Right.
I would definitely recommend this one.
Who was the guy who did drew the early stuff for Daredevil for Mark Waid? Not Sam Knee, but before that.
Marcos Martin.
Yeah, it reminded me a bit of Marcos Martin and some of those other artists. I think there was another one in there, too, before Sam Knee. That basically all the artists that they had on that had a certain kind of look. And this seems like also, you know, a continuation in some ways of that look.
Dave, what is your pick?
My pick is the second issue of Hi-Fi Fight Club.
Is there a Fight Club in this one?
yeah, there was a Fight Club in the first one.
Oh. I thought they were cigarette vigilantes or something.
Oh, yeah, I guess so. They just call it a fight club. There's training and stuff in this one. But, yeah, what's the name of the our lead girl? So I'm just going to completely blank on her name. So this is a the first one I picked previously. Has a girl who's she's either she's college age, and she's working in a kind of indie record store and has all that kind of little hipster vibe of what are the movies?
Empire Records
and
High Fidelity.
High Fidelity, and she's got a crush on one of the girls there. She herself is like, I guess, a little on the tomboyish side. She's got a crush on one of the girls. All the staffers are girls, and has just found out at the end of the first issue that yes, they are secret vigilantes.
Yeah.
The interesting thing is that although it's that's sort of treated lightly in this, you know, it's not like the world threatened. Like they're not like, oh no, we might die tonight. You know.
Yeah.
It's treated lightly. It's like, hey, this is a fun thing we go out and do. And it's not, like, quite superhero things, either. It's sort of like we rescue a missing... They're trying to, in this case, find a missing... there was a band that was going to play at their shop, and they've gone missing. And the band is Stegosaur, which I'm guessing is a Mastodon stand-in. They've allowed her to have a shot at it, but she's having some friction with one or two of the other girls. She's kind of the awkward, I don't know if I belong here, but yeah, I'm crushing on this girl, and I might be trying to willing to stick out, you know, the jabs of the other girl in order to try and fit in, because otherwise this is my dream job, and fighting alongside this cute chick would be awesome. And then it kind of goes to the... they all kind of get in on their mission planning in this one, and she's feeling left out, like she doesn't know what to do and doesn't have anything to contribute to the group. But later that night, she ends up hanging out, talking to the girl she has a crush on, who seems at least very friendly to her as far as like, hey, I think we can get you through this. I think you could fit in. And there is a sort of will they, won't they kind of thing going on. And along with some nice character dynamics. Like, I really like all the characters in this. The art continues to be fantastic throughout. It reminds me of Takeshi Miyazawa and some other artists of that stripe, influenced by manga a little bit, but just as much, I would say, by... I mean, it also reminded me of the artist who did that Spider-Man, Generation Spider-Man one.
Yeah.
It's honestly, I like it better than Zodiac Star Force, which is the other, you know, it's not actually that close to. Zodiac Star Force was the one about the kind of the slightly more realistic Sailor Moon spin.
Right.
Here, they're closer to like real kids, and it's also a little bit lighter. There's a John Hughes vibe to it, too. But there's a little, you know, the relationships and stuff feel real enough that I like the characters more in this than I did in the Sailor Moon one. And it's just because I was never a Sailor Moon person.
Yeah.
Never seen it.
What about your backup pick?
Backup pick is one that I've talked about many times, but is now in a collected edition, which is Jeff Lemire's Royal City. Royal City is a slightly sprawling sort of family drama. That also may have a kind of ghost in it.
Okay.
It's about a town that's town of Royal City, which is on the cusp of, I think, like, you know, a financial decline.
Yeah, they had a big factory that
One of the characters in there has a big proposal that she's trying to push through, and everybody has some difficulty going on. You know, there's like, I'm trying to think, does the dad have like dementia or something?
Yeah, something like that.
There's one of them who's kind of... I think an addict and
definitely a screw up brother,
the screw up who's like, I need money fast to pay off a loan.
Isn't the lead sort of a writer type?
Yep,
he's like going through a divorce.
He's a writer going through a divorce, and there's some stuff in there that Lemire writes that I'm like, I feel like he may have at some point been all of those people.
Yeah, yeah.
Because he has such a voice for it, and like it feels really real. And then there's the strange, slightly, you know, quasi supernatural thing, which is to say, at some point, the parents lost a child, it seems like, yeah. And which would have been a brother to some of the siblings in this mix. And he appears to them, to all the different characters, at different ages of what he would have been. Mm-hmm. So as an adult, as a teenager, as a kid. And that part remains unexplained, but I think it's his deepest writing to date.
It's one of my favorite things he's written, and it's one of those things that sounds like it could be boring. It is not in any way boring. It's actually really, really intriguing, and the art that he does is fantastic.
Yeah, I also think it's a new peak for his art. This town feels like a real place, as surely as like some of the better drawn like Stephen King towns.
Yeah,
Every story in it is in some way intriguing to me.
Also, it's one of Image's $10 trades.
Yeah, I was just looking at that. So, Royal City, Volume 1, I'm buying it, and you should, too, if you don't want to get your ass beat.
Wow, so we're going aggressive.
I was flipping through it, and I came across the screw-up kid, and I decided to take on a little of his personality.
Dave's going for the real hard stuff.
That's right.
The big payback. All right, I'm going to hit my backup pick, and then we'll go to Nick's pick, because it's going to be one we're all going to talk about.
Yep.
Yeah.
So my backup pick is Rat Queen Special, Orc Dave, number one. Orc Dave is one of the four Daves in the Rat Queens. It's one of the rival adventuring companies. He's the sexy man mount orc, bearded.
Love interest for one of the characters.
Love
right?
interest for Vi. And this goes back to his history. So their take on orcs here is basically that they are sort of back to nature druids. So it's like, this is all about Dave and his father, who's like this druid who's taking him to see the trees. The trees are kind of smarting off at him. And he's sort of learning about his responsibilities to the forest and, you know, protecting civilization from it and dealing with the monsters in it. And he is more of a kind-hearted person than his father. And we see sort of that stress between them. We also see, you know, the Rat Queens do show up. This is his first meeting with them. And they're pretty hilarious. And Dave has a sort of, he wants to go to civilization. He wants to not ignore all his responsibilities, but he doesn't want to just live out in the forest and be a druid orc. It's a really interesting take on the orc. There's an interesting culture thing built up here. It's a good, solid character piece.
This is the same writer as Rat Queens, right?
Yeah. And it's got really nice art by Max Dunbar. Like, I think this art was fantastic. So I really enjoyed this. I think if you're reading Rat Queens, you definitely want it. If you're not, it's probably a good sampler to see if this is the kind of world you might be interested in. It's not quite as over-the-top rambunctious as Rat Queens is at times. It's got a little more heart, but it definitely has that sort of world-building and D&D done right that Rat Queens does so well. So definitely worth a look. Nick, do you want to talk about your pick?
Yeah, I think we're all going to talk about this one, though, because it's a big one,
yeah.
And that is Marvel Legacy number one.
This thing's like 100,000 pages, right?
It is like triple sized, like, I feel like.
An 80-page giant.
Yes.
I'm betting it's more like a 60-page giant.
And where do we want to begin with this one? Because I don't want to spoil anything.
Well, basically what it is, so like,
it's basically a primer for the direction that Marvel is going.
Multi-storied.
It is that, but it's also sort of the creation of this new sort of legacy going back to 1 million BC.
That's true. There is that as well, and that involves many of the, not many, there's like six, right, or seven Marvel characters that have sort of have a lineage.
Ghost Rider, Phoenix.
Starbrand,
a bunch of stuff like that.
Doctor Strange, Odin, and... And we sort of see...
Starbrand is definitely the oddest one, but the rest are all pretty familiar characters.
I mean, Starbrand has definitely been put back into prominence the past couple of years with Jonathan Hickman.
But I bet if you're not, like, a follower of either the events or Avengers, probably most people are like, wait, Starbrand is what now?
Yeah, Starbrand is their Green Lantern / Quasar type guy.
Right.
Yeah. He was basically like the Earth's defense, like, put into a person.
He's got... The Starbrand is a tattoo that gives you cosmic power.
Yeah.
It's from the new universe of all things.
Right.
Yep. That Warren Ellis tried to revive a couple of years ago. And
numerous people have tried to revive the new universe.
Yeah.
But you don't need to know any of his backstory.
Nope. You get pretty much everything you need to know about sort of what his deal is, what the 1 million BC Avengers are. And from there, we get sort of a story involving Starbrand and the new Ghost Rider.
Yeah.
And that's sort of kind of a story told throughout the entire issue. And then you get little snippets of all the major characters, I guess sort of glimpses of what their new books are going to be like.
It's basically, this is the thing we get a lot of people come at us after, like, Civil War, Secret Invasion, that kind of thing. They're always like, what's next? What happened after that? And this is the answer to what happened after Secret Empire. Like, obviously it's going to continue in all the Marvel books.
Yeah.
But if you're like, I just read a Secret Empire Omega, what happens next? this is what happens next.
Right. This is the primer for all things Marvel, basically, for the next year, at least.
And so there's some pages with Captain America. By the way, some pages with a notable character I won't mention.
Deadpool, Doctor Strange.
Yeah, everybody, which it feels like, I guess Jason Aaron wrote all of this, but maybe he had some input from the creative teams of others, because there's some artists and stuff from other runs.
The art is all super good, I noticed.
Well, it is all of the... it's all written by Aaron, but it's mainly with Asad Rubick and Steve McNiven, and then it runs the gamut from Chris Samnee, Russell Dodderman, Alex Maleev, Ed McGuinness, Stuart Inman, Pepe Larraz, Jim Chung, Daniel Acuna, Greg Land, and Jay Weinstein.
Everybody who's working on the next legacy books, like the creative teams are coming on, they are there to do... this is their first shot at those characters.
A number of big things do happen in it, and I have a feeling people are going to want to seek it out for one or two of them in particular.
Yeah, I know which one you're thinking of that as well.
Yeah, we're gonna completely
avoid
that. But
there's also a fun story with Thor, Sam Wilson, and Ironheart that I actually really enjoyed.
Yeah, sort of the new Avengers. I kind of like that too.
Yeah, and there is a sort of overarching big threat for that we've uncovered for the new legacy. So it'll be interesting. And I was actually really enthused for the stories, and I'm curious to see where some of these threads end up taking us.
I think one of the problems with these kind of books that can be an issue is, I mean, Marvel's done this before, these point ones and all that kind of thing. They can feel like an anthology book where there's no weight to anything. That is definitely not the feel of this book. Like, I feel like we're getting a story as well as glimpses of what's going to be coming up.
And I think sort of a glimpse of sort of the fun nature of comics in a lot of ways.
I'm going to, like, you can edit this out if this is not something we want to reveal, but I think it was kind of known that this is a thing that's coming up. There's a glimpse of Fantastic Four-related stuff in
here. Yeah, they're definitely going to lead to the Fantastic Four.
And it's short.
The Ben and
Johnny.
But it's like a mission statement. It's like, hey guys, we know you missed them.
Right. And I thought it was nicely done. It had some energy to it. It like suggested that it suggested some respect for the FF that, you know, you might have felt was lacking at Marvel lately. And it seems like if it was, then they have been rethinking it.
Yeah, I actually think that sort of pervades the whole thing. If you've been unhappy about the current direction of Marvel, and if it's not just because you've got issues with there not being enough white people in it, if you actually are like someone who just like, I love Ms. Marvel, I love Ms. Marvel, I love Miles Morales, but I want Peter Parker and
just
I want regular
guys.
Thor. You miss your guys?
Or I miss Tony Stark.
Yeah.
Or...
you're going to be happy with this because I think they struck the balance that they needed to, which is not throwing away all the steps they've made for good new characters, but also acknowledging that, we do kind of miss the guys who have been pushed to the background.
Yeah. And I mean, I don't know what more to say. I mean, it's one of those things, if you're a fan of Marvel, I think you're going to want to pick up.
Yeah, there's some big stuff, and I think people who are casually interested in Marvel will want to read it. The people who are reading Marvel books in general will definitely want to read this.
Yeah.
What else is on your stack, Nick?
Action Comics 988, which is the second part of the Oz Effect.
That was almost your pick as well.
It was. I actually was... I thought the first issue was just okay, but sort of seeing Juergens' explanation of why the character who is Oz is Oz, I thought it was really well done in the second part and sort of well-defined. While they're still being a mystery overall, and I thought the art by... no wonder. I didn't see who it was. It's Ryan Sook. And it's beautiful. Detective Comics 965, which is a story dedicated to Tim Drake, sort of in the hands of Mr. Oz and what he's doing to get out of it. But it's also just sort of an exploration of who Tim Drake really is. And I thought that James Tynion continues to just hit the nail on the head with this series. It is great. Then we have the Dark Knight's metal tie-in Batman the Murder Machine, which
I think you gotta say Batman the Murder Machine.
Sure.
If we go that route.
This tells the tale of the dark multiverse Batman that has been sort of taken over Cyborg specifically to destroy his world. Well, he would say save.
Right.
But the incursion of against our Cyborg. Suicide Squad number 26 continues the crossover between Green Arrow, Teen Titans, and Nightwing. Lots of fun to be had there. Nightwing: The New Order, the number two, which continues sort of this dark future where Dick Grayson has taken away all the superpowers.
Yep.
Only to find out that his son has superpowers.
Whoops.
Yeah, there's that.
Ain't that always the way? Life is like, I'm so ironic.
Yeah. Life finds a way.
So he has to sort of make decisions. And then the...
Sorry, kid.
And then the fourth issue of Venomverse, which after the exploits of last one and the introduction of Carnage, we get Gwynpool. So all the craziness is hitting Venomverse.
Okay. Dave, what else is on your list?
Let's see. I've got a really awesome standalone issue of that series Rebels from Brian Wood.
Yep.
This one has a neat idea. There's a... is it the, is it just called, like, the Battle of New York, or is it the Battle of Brooklyn Heights? I forget. It's a one-off about a couple of kids, and I say kids, like, teenagers, late teens, in 1777, who come to Alexander Hamilton, one of them does, with a story about a sunken ship in the bay... from the Battle of Brooklyn, that where basically George Washington got run out of New York by British troops, but a sunken British ship that they found out through a series of circumstances was carrying gold, that it's basically at the bottom of the bay, and they, because they live there, know that it, instead of dropping down like 100 feet to very difficult to get stuff, was like sort of the ship was over like a sort of shelf area that was really only like about 20 feet down. And they have, it's kind of about these two kids eking out, because their parents have died. They're trying to keep their farm safe during, you know, British, you know, quasi-occupation, and then also maybe contribute to the war effort with this gold. So anyway, really fascinating standalone story, beautiful artwork that kind of captures the... icy time that gave us, you know, that was like the era of Valley Forge and a particularly harsh winter. So that was a good standalone issue if you ever want to just try Rebels without knowing anything else about it or some of its other stories that they've told in there. You could read this issue, issue 7, completely on its own. Justice League Power Rangers wraps with issue 6. It's a very fun finale. I didn't love it quite as much as the early stuff when the character dynamics are first going into play,
right.
But there is a lot of cool stuff, including a little hint of a possible follow-up at some point. It does end on, not a cliffhanger, but a, wait, did that happen too? There's a new book that was kind of a nicely drawn book from Titan Comics I just want to mention called The Beautiful Death. I haven't had a chance to read it yet, but it seems to be sort of a post-apocalyptic sort of survivalist story with really nice European-inspired artwork. This particular apocalypse seems to have been an insect apocalypse.
Sure.
Not your usual nuclear, chemical, or alien one, although there could be an alien thing. I'm not sure. But definitely insects. I want to read this later, also from Titan Comics, Captain Kronos, Vampire Hunter.
Yep.
This is based on an old Hammer movie that I watched like when I was a kid.
Well, I just saw the creative
team. And it's the creative team is Dan Abnett, who I like, and Tom Mandrake, drew the Spectre back in the day, awesome guy. Great at horror stuff.
Yeah.
You know, he's got some Bernie Wrightson and stuff to him. At the time when I saw this, I mean, you know, the movie was probably made in like the late 60s or early 70s, kind of for the sort of lurid Hammer films. There weren't a lot of movies, honestly, about like vampire hunter guys on that level, and I'd be curious to see how Dan Abnett's spin on that story. Lastly, just wanted to also mention that Ted Nafe's superhero book Heroines does get a nice little collected edition from who puts it out? Is that
Space Goat or something like that?
Oh,
that's weird. Yeah.
Oh, weird. I guess I thought it was some more notable publisher.
Nope.
Anyway, but if you're a follower of Ted Nafe in general, you're gonna want to probably pick up the collection.
Yeah, that was good. I've only read the first couple, but I want to read the rest of it. For me, just the three Image books that I want to throw in there: Saga number 47. Lazarus X plus 66, which falls in on the parents of a couple of characters who were sort of lifted to service the family, and what it looks like when you suddenly are go from being waste to being serfs,
right?
Which is an interesting thing, and they're out in like L.A. living it up, and they're not thrilled about this new status quo they're in. They're in San Francisco, but basically they're living a sort of upper middle class existence all of a sudden, and there's some guilt involved in that. And then finally, Redneck number 6, which wraps the first story arc of the East Texas Vampire story that Donnie Cates has been doing, and I like that quite a bit as well. All right. I think that's it for comics. We'll be back for just a sec. We'll be back in just a second. We're talking about some TV that's come up.
Star Trek.
Next, going to mention a movie. And we're going to do our spoiler review of Star Trek Discovery. All right, the fall season is upon us, which you might know by the prevalence of pumpkin spice, the fact that it's raining outside, mm-hmm. and the fact that TV has started up again.
Yes. And that Randy bears a mournful scowl.
I bear a mournful scowl. I do not care for the I do not care for the fall. I prefer hashtag summer forever.
Yep.
But I will live with this this terrible drought of mediocre weather that you all seem to love
yes.
so much. But I also, TV is a year-round thing for me, so the fall season no longer really has any.
I mean, it didn't used to be. It really didn't.
No, but at this point, like, the network stuff is not the stuff that ever really intrigues me,
right.
for the most part. But Nick, I know you still greet the fall season with some news.
I do.
You try everything out.
I always try everything, and
so you watched a few.
I watched a few. There's three that I'll talk about. One's The Good Doctor, which. About sort of an autistic savant who becomes a sort of doctor for a San Francisco hospital.
Yeah.
It's okay. It's a little heavy-handed. I watch it because it has Richard Schiff on it, which I love. I really
Richard
love
Schiff.
Richard Schiff. And a couple of other players.
Quick remind me, because I'm terrible with actors, Richard
he's
Schiff.
Toby from West Wing.
Thank you.
He's just a great actor. I mean, he was also in Jurassic Park 2, Lost World, so, I mean, he kind of runs the gamut of things.
So not every choice is as strong as West Wing,
no.
but when he's at his best, he's really good.
He's actually, he's also in Ballers right now, and he's great in it.
Oh,
so.
He was on, what was the Michael Weston?
He was in Burn Notice.
Burn Notice.
Yes.
The Good Doctor, I don't know if it's going to last. It's a little wears its heart on its sleeve. There's a promise of it being okay.
Like schlockily?
But kind of schlocky. It is kind of schlocky.
What I'm hearing is, I'm glad I skipped it.
Yeah, I took a bullet for you on that one. Talking about bullets, I will say The Brave, I was a little bit more into than the reviews are coming in saying it's pretty bland. And
that's not David Boreanaz's thing.
No, that's SEAL Team,
right,
which
right.
premieres Wednesday, which I will...
It's essentially the same show.
I mean...
Just like Castle and Bones are the same show.
Yeah, this one is specifically about a group of military operatives that rescue endangered U.S. citizens from whatever hostile environment
okay.
they are.
Let me ask you a question. Are they brave?
They are brave.
Okay.
Is it
like a realistic spin on it, like Tom Clancy style, or is it kind
here's
of more
the thing. It
character-y
walks the
or...
line between Tom Clancy and G.I. Joe.
Okay.
Because I swear to God, they have sort of the demeanor of some G.I. Joe characters, and I'm like, you may have won me over because of that fact.
There's not a line there. That's not a line. There's a big gulf between those two things.
The characters have individual personalities.
You know, if you look at like some of the characters in like some of those, you said between Tom Clancy and stuff like that.
Yeah.
You know, Domingo Chavez and stuff like that, and what's the third
I
one?
Mean, he's the guy from
Clear and Present Danger.
Clear and Present
yeah,
Danger. Some of those guys, they have some larger-than-life personalities.
He came up with the guy that did Splinter, the main character of Splinter Cell. He was a big guy. And
yeah.
I don't know. But the operatives have sort of individual, like, specialties, and...
Are they like, I pilot a submarine, and I am the flamethrower guy?
No, they don't go to that extent. But they do give them a bigger personality than I was expecting
right.
from just bland soldiers.
Are there any ninjas?
One of them actually has a nickname that is Ninja.
Okay. Right.
So I was a little... She is actually pretty awesome. She's their
but
sniper.
Are they based on like a real, like an actual group of some sort?
I don't know. It's sort of CIA operative type.
Okay. It
but
sounds like it's meant to be an opportunity to do G.I. Joe-esque kind of heightened military rescue operations.
And you're getting that
operations.
Side of things, and then sort of the operations side, and the main character is Anne Heche, which
okay.
I like Anne Heche, so
sure.
Her is sort of this... CIA overlord is kind of fun.
I can actually see that of her. I feel like she could tell somebody to go wipe out somebody, whatever.
Yeah,
whatever it is
so.
CIA people do.
Yeah.
So I'm going to give that a couple more episodes. I mean, like Randy said, it's kind of generic and formulaic like all those shows, but I have a fondness for that
sure.
kind of thing. So
Hey, Bones was a good show.
Yeah.
That's
then
one where he was a writer, right?
Yep.
No, that was Castle.
I know. I wasn't going to give Randy the satisfaction.
And then the other show is a 30-minute sitcom called Me, Myself, and I, which is told a character's life told from three different points in his life. As a kid of about 10, at him at 30, where he is sort of going through a divorce, has a kid, and then told when he's, I think, like, 80 or 75, however old John Larroquette is,
because that's not 80.
Can Jesus. I also? I mean, John Larroquette's getting. I bet he's in. He could be in the 70s.
I think he's in his late 70s.
Can I just, by the way, say that there's also? I'd like to just surmise, and I'm probably wrong here, but I'm going to surmise. Is there also one that shows his experiences back on the island? He was trapped there.
Yeah, yeah.
No, and well, the kid is played.
This sounds like an interesting idea.
The kid is played by one of the kids who was in It.
Yeah,
The one who plays Eddie, the one who's sort of has all the health stuff.
Oh yeah, yeah, sure.
I don't know Finn Wolfhound.
The hypochondriac.
The hypochondriac.
Yeah.
Thank you. The middle-aged guy is played by Bobby Moynihan
from
Saturday Night Live. Who in Saturday Night Live he was always kind of over the top. Here he's definitely more reined in. He's got some of that personality. His best friend is Urkel, which I can't remember.
Wow, really?
Yeah, he's Michael Jamal.
He's also in his 80s.
No. He actually is great in it as sort of his best friend and kind of his compatriot in his business plans. He's kind of his tinkerer, inventor, which is kind of interesting.
I need to get an inventor at some point.
Yeah.
And then John Larroquette sort of is at the. When he's retiring and sort of. And he finds the love of his life at that age. So it's kind of this. Interesting, funny, but also sweet, and kind of hits a soft spot for me. I really enjoyed the pilot. I don't know if the story has a lot of legs, but I really enjoyed it.
I never saw that Richard Linklater movie Boyhood, but I believe it was filmed over the course of like a decade or so.
Yeah,
and covered
it was.
A kid literally growing up. And so the different version of some of the same ideas here. This is obviously has the broader spectrum, but it sounds like an intriguing idea. Like there would be for sure storytelling possibilities there.
Yeah, I thought it was a really good pilot, and it's going.
Did they show any of the scenes though, like where Deathstroke trains him, or is that later?
No, that's hilarious. he does have a Michael Jordan obsession.
So Michael Jordan at some point will have to train him in the ways of the Force.
I'm sure.
All right, so we're gonna do we'll do spoilers for Star Trek Discovery.
Yep.
So if you have not seen it, stop listening to the podcast.
Yep.
Go pirate it like everybody else. and come back.
I think, by the way, as far as if somebody was looking to find it, they could probably on CBS's website, I'm guessing, the first episode?
Nope.
Not even the first one?
Nope.
Nope.
Oh, wow.
They want people to buy
They were like,
access.
So they broadcast it live, and then the other one you had to get it through CBS All Access.
They are giving you like a week free or something.
Yeah, you can get a week free.
So you can watch the first two episodes,
okay.
And then cancel your subscription.
Or
if you want to be that
keep
way.
A subscription because we generally like this. And
yeah.
In fact, there's a lot of like going on for
in,
it.
In fact, given that Dave is the Star Trek fanatic of the three of us, I'm surprised that I seem to be the one who liked it the most.
I think that's true. Yeah, I had some... I think I sort of just felt like the writing was not as gripping as I wanted it to be, knowing that it was meant to kind of somewhat go toe-to-toe with the more of the premium format TV stuff today. So I was like, you know, I was expecting a little bit more Breaking Bad level writing, along with hopefully the big sci-fi concepts and stuff like that.
I think for me, what I really liked this, and I thought they did a great job. I really liked all the characters.
Yep.
And I thought, as someone who has a knowledge of Star Trek, but hardly an intimate familiarity with, like I've watched a couple episodes of every series.
Sure.
And I've seen all the movies.
But you weren't enthused for this. In fact, I think you were rather wary, especially given a little bit of the behind-the-scenes conundrums, like losing Brian Fuller.
Yeah, my expectations were somewhat low.
Right. And we'll quick say, here's just what the premise is, that you have... Not in fact in the first two episodes, the Discovery ship, although we know that's going to play a role, but you have a ship called the Shenzhou, captained by Michelle Yeoh.
Yep.
Her first officer is Michael Burnham, who is the first woman or first human to be like trained at the Vulcan Science Academy,
right.
And has been serving on her ship for 7 years and has something of Vulcan-like demeanor and some of that harshness of judgment at times.
Right.
but has, by the time we know her, has softened on that a bit.
Quite a bit.
But there will be flashbacks, and you also see her childhood. And she has a link to Sarek, which is Spock's dad. He's like her ward. And
he's her mentor.
He's his ward.
What?
Well, that is to say, she is his ward.
She is his ward.
Right. Randy was just saying, I would say he is not her.
That'd be a weird relationship.
Or is that...
Mentor,
I forget how that term...
ward.
Ah, whatever. A dangerous situation emerges with the Klingons when something goes down, or it's like navigational buoy kind of
thing. Yeah.
And the Shenzhou goes to investigate it, and they find this sort of ancient Klingon ship that is rather coolly covered in like coffins.
Yeah, that was cool.
Like when Klingons die, they like put them in these coffins, sarcophagi, and they like kind of like stick them on the outside of the ship, so there's like thousands of them.
Don't they refer to the fleet as like the Black Fleet?
The Black Fleet, yeah. And there are weird Klingon sect that venerates, like, is it Kalis, the famous Klingon?
Yeah.
And but kind of a strange religious cult. And essentially, by the end of the episode, they're like on the brink of war.
Yeah. I really like the focus on the Klingons. Like, we definitely see a lot of their point of view. They spent a lot of time on Tuvka, something like that.
T'Kuvma.
They're sort of a renegade religious leader who's trying to bring all the tribes together.
Yep.
They
mentioned
sense.
That they want to definitely show a lot of this from the Klingon perspective. And they mentioned the 24 houses of the Klingons, which are like in disarray right now. But he has notions for bringing them together.
Yeah, and that's sort of what the whole thing is about. And at the same time, Michael's history with the Klingons, where they launched like a terrorist attack. I love the idea that the Klingons were basically launching terrorist attacks against the Federation. That it was like a, not even a Cold War. It was just like them attacking.
Right.
I
forgot to mention, this is set 10 years before Kirk's time.
Yeah.
So the analogy you were mentioning earlier, Randy, was that if like Kirk's era was clearly an analog to the Cold War with high tensions between the Klingons, but only like flare-ups of war.
Yeah.
This is maybe going to be more like World War II.
This is where World War II starts.
This is like the big wartime, and it's almost as if you were to. And these aren't all direct analogs, but like if prior to that, as if the Klingons were more like operating like terrorists.
Yeah.
And then we are going to see it escalate to, during this season, to full-scale war, it looks like.
I really liked all the characters they did here, even the ones they blew up, maybe. I really liked the interplay between Michelle Yeoh's character and Michael, Sonequa Green. What's her first name? I'm blanking her name. But I liked her. Yeah. I thought she was great. I really liked all the production design. I know there's been some controversy about those aren't Klingons. They don't look right. I love the new look.
I think I don't think anybody would. I would hope would deny that they don't look. They look good.
Yeah.
They elongated their heads a little bit. There's more elaborate kind of quality to their dress. It's a little bit more ornamental. But these are also like a specific sect, so it sort of made sense. Nick, what was your did you like the look of the Klingons?
Yeah, no, I had no issues with the Klingons. I felt like that they were very Klingon-ish. I mean, no, they didn't have the exact look, the old school, the next generation.
They did sort of speak in that sort of tribal, formal way that we're used to from Next Generation, especially.
Yes.
I did. It was weird to me to like not. Almost as just like a bone to the fans to throw out when they were glimpsing some of the people from the different houses to show some of the more traditional look of, say, the Next Generation Klingons. Just to kind of acknowledge it, because fans, like, it's a weird, like, kind of erasure of, like, a popular design. Like, just why would you change it sort of thing? But the things, the Klingons look good. They feel like Klingons. You're not going to be like, that doesn't even remotely resemble a Klingon.
It's not like they basically took a warrior race and made them like pacifists. They're definitely warrior. They're definitely out for sort of
honestly, there
vengeance.
Was a bigger change between, say, the original series and Next Generation Klingons, where in the original series they were very guileful and cunning and like they were not about honor in the original series. That was really something that was layered in for Next Generation.
Right.
They kind of flip-flopped them with Romulans.
Yeah.
In general, Nick, what were your thoughts? Did you like, or what did you like or dislike?
I have to agree with Randy. I liked the characters. I especially liked their science officer quite a bit. Yeah,
Lieutenant Saru.
Yeah, I think his character too. And sort of the notions behind his race, sort of the predator-prey.
Yeah, they mentioned that the way his people you're like born like as part of like one or two genetic castes, yeah. It sounds like. You're either predator or prey.
And like he can
and he's
sense,
prey.
And he basically can sense death, and that sort of is an ominous feel that gives to...
Right, he has like this sort of precognitive I know that this, you know, war or death is coming.
But he's also kind of, I mean, not a coward, but he kind of has cowardly streaks.
That's supposed to, they sort of make out that, you know, I've often heard it, you know, mentioned it, that is going to be what people think of him, but there's, like, more going on than that.
And I liked the interplay between him and Burnham's characters, sort of kind of the two different...
They kind of snip a little bit at each other.
Yeah.
In debating things in front of the captain.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was interesting to have for the first time a lead character who was not the captain.
Yeah.
And who, in fact, very notably, mutinies against the captain.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're spoiling stuff.
That was one of the things I had the. I understood the decision to do the mutiny, and I honestly probably would have sided with Burnham's character. But it feels weird that your main character is this person who is. You know, mutinied, tried to take over the starship, and you're supposed to root for her. It's weird.
I didn't find that at all weird, because she was right.
Except that you also agreed, Randy, that you think that even if she had done that, that things probably still would have fallen apart.
Right.
Because Tecumseh needed a battle to happen.
Right, but I think that she was right. The captain was mishandling the situation. The captain thought she was doing one thing that was not happening.
Well, she was following Starfleet regulation and sort of adhering to that.
The notion of firing first is so antithetical to like Federation and like probably almost any right-thinking person.
Yeah.
And it's what I did think was a neat bit of writing was, and something that they will clearly revisit throughout the show is that Commander Burnham. Has a portion of the Katra, the soul of Sarek, I guess when he used it to kind of help her overcome like the loss of her parents earlier, like when she was a child, and anybody who's seen like Star Trek
was bringing him back from the
from the dead.
She was as a child was almost killed, and he basically saved her.
Right, it's like he imbued her with a bit of his life force.
Yeah.
And anybody who knows that remembers like Star Trek 3 and 4 knows that Katra is what Spock put in Dr. McCoy to kind of eventually rebirth himself. And so that's that weird Vulcan mysticism.
Mm-hmm.
But what it means for the show is that she is able to across the Gulf of Space, not all the time, but it looks like with some effort from Sarek to kind of commune with him.
Yeah.
And he will probably offer advice as he does in this one on what the neat idea of the Vulcan hello.
Yeah.
Which in this case would be you fire first because she asks, how did you deal with your first with the Klingons? And it's like the Vulcans were like, we analyzed, you know, their the way their society worked, and we knew that you basically bloody their nose first, and then they respect you. So that's their Vulcan hello to them. She wanted that to happen, and it didn't.
Yeah.
And but things go really badly.
Also, I want to say one of the things that if I haven't complained about the show, it is that it's still a little action-y.
Yeah.
It's definitely more in the vein of the movies. There's a lot of action and adventure, and it's a little dark. But there was still some of what I want from Trek is to be sort of the problem solving, whether it's the opening where they like release the water onto the planet or walking, and we didn't even mention this, but when she walks in a pattern to create
it's the Starfleet Delta.
Delta.
Yeah.
That was cool.
Did you
figure out what she was doing before they did it?
I knew about it that was a prominently featured scene on the trailer that they unfortunately showed the pullback.
Oh, that's too bad.
So yeah, I think a few of those things got a little bit blunted for me just because I've been doing this podcast and looking at all the advanced material.
I have not been looking at any of it, so I didn't know any of this going in. I hadn't seen a single minute of footage.
You know when she runs off to later, Commander Burnham runs off to commune with Sarek, and she doesn't tell the captain what she's doing because they're in a very tense, hurried situation.
Right.
I was kind of thinking it's like this is payback for not telling me about the footprint thing.
But there's also the bit where she has to convince the computer to use its ethics protocols to. Yeah. Her get out of her cell.
I thought that was one of the coolest scenes and like a very much a Kirk type of scene, but without kind of doing the modernizing the idea where she tries to outwit the computer to let her out of the brig.
Right.
And at first it doesn't work. So she tries a few other options and eventually she figures it out.
Yeah. I liked that a lot.
The special effects were good. I thought their ships looked good.
Yeah, I love the production design.
I'll be honest, from the previews, I like the design of the Shenzhou more than the Discovery.
Yeah, the Shenzhou looked great. I think Discovery, we still don't know about the Discovery. That's a complaint that I've heard from people, which is legit, that this was not the first episode of Discovery. This was like the Zero issue.
Right.
And it is two episodes before we even see the ship.
Right. Like, it's not as if nothing happens.
No.
In fact, a whole bunch of stuff happens.
It's just that what the status quo of the show is, we don't know yet.
Right. For instance, we know the commander of their captain of the Discovery is played by Jason Isaacs.
We haven't even met him yet.
We haven't met him yet, but they did show here's a little bit of what's from the next season, so you do glimpse him. And it's clear that a number of characters from the Shenzhou will find themselves on the Discovery, which will become the status quo.
But the thing I think is important is what they needed to do here was not set up the Discovery and its crew and all that kind of thing. Yes, you need to do that eventually. What they needed to do is prove they could make a Star Trek show that wasn't boring, that felt enough like Star Trek that would win over the fans, that would grab non-Star Trek fans, and that would just be a good show. And I feel like they did all of that.
Well, just kind of watching my friends' reactions on Facebook, that is, broadly speaking, it's going over quite well.
Yeah.
Do you think that CBS is going to garner the basically attention they need to
for
launch
streaming?
This all access?
Yes, but then all access is going to die as soon as Discovery goes away, unless they've got something else in the wings, because nobody is going to stick around for CBS's content. That's their problem with CBS All Access.
Yeah.
But there's a whole theory about that all access is some kind of
negotiating
tactic,
tool.
Which I haven't looked up that article yet, but at any rate,
like it could be the case.
The ratings were great. They had like 9.6 million, which is a really good debut for a Star Trek show.
Yeah.
It also was hugely pirated, just like Game of Thrones, which is also weirdly a good sign for them. It means there's interest.
I mean, we live in an era of piracy being common.
Yard.
If people are pirating your show, it means they like your show or are interested in your show.
They want to see it.
I did have my sort of... I wish the writing had crackled a little bit more. I liked all the characters, and I also felt like it was a little bit of a downer for Trek.
Yeah.
I'm interested in the situation and to see, like, of course they've got like upcoming stuff like Harry Mudd will show up.
Yeah.
I heard something that I told Nick about earlier, and I don't want to actually say what it is on this. That was a leaked thing of something sort of a classic Trek sort of thing that may show up in there. And I'm like, if that actually happens in the first season, I can't imagine quite how it would happen because it does not seem to fit the story that they're doing, which is a long-form story.
Right.
This is not like every episode they go to a different planet. This is there will be episodic elements to it, but they will be telling a very large story about a wartime situation.
Yeah. I was going to say, is this more the Buffy formula where it was they didn't have a big bad, but they had every once in a while
it feels actually
sort of
tighter than that. It feels more like Babylon 5 seasons like 2 and 3 when they were like heavily into the War of the Shadows and every episode was about the War of the Shadows in some way or it would impact them in some way.
Yeah.
That's the vibe that I'm getting. They've specifically said that the seasons will be based around singular stories.
Yeah.
Here's a question, and I haven't looked very hard into this. How many episodes is the season going to be?
13.
Is it 13?
Yeah.
Okay.
Which is what it should be. 22 episode seasons are dead, and they should stay dead.
And I saw that in the credits. I mean, Brian Fuller is still.
He was heavily involved. He wrote. I mean, he wrote the original treatments. They've modified it, but this is all still based on his work.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know if you know. He like did work on Trek back in like the 90s. He like did some stuff for DS9 and Voyager. So he's already had a hand, and there is the possibility he may return. That seems like it's a little on the remote end from what I've read, but it does seem like it's a possibility. But it's definitely a pretty strong proof of concept for them.
Yeah.
If people are looking, by the way, for more, I know that the comics are going to tie into this and tell T'Kuvma's backstory.
Oh, interesting.
And there was a novel that debuts today. It debuted as of midnight. And my co-podcaster, Fathery, who we've been reviewing this for Text Trek. And if you want my slightly more negative first impressions, I'm planning to watch it again outside of a group to catch some of the lines and stuff I missed. We just put up our podcast of that. But he also gave me as a birthday present, he sent me money to get the first book because we're going to book club read that one. And that's the story of, it looks like it's Burnham approximately a year prior to the TV show.
Okay.
So it well into her time with serving under Michelle Yeoh's character, but prior to the events.
Interesting. I'm kind of jonesing to go back and rewatch it. I really liked it.
Yeah, it's one of those that has... It's grown on me the more I've thought about it. Fathery liked it more than I did, but had some reservations. But he's already rewatched it, and he said that it grew in his esteem on and revisit, and I have a feeling it probably will for me, too. Yeah. Kind of one of those, I need to match in my head what expectations a little bit. As much as I did kind of know some plot beats and things like that, I didn't know what the tone was going to be and some of that, and so it intrigues me.
I went in expecting it was going to be CBS crappy.
Right.
And so it
instead they seem to really have put a lot of weight behind it and some quality storytelling.
Yeah. So I'm very much anxiously awaiting the rest of it. All right. That wraps it up for us this week. We'll be back next week with more. Until that time,
Yo Joe.
Thanks for listening. If you like the show, do us a favor and spread the word to your friends. Or give us a quick 5-star rating and review on iTunes to help us grow our audience. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or at www.roguesgallerytx.com. We'll be back next week.